It's Thursday, 22nd August. It's 9:45, and the Polygot data session continues.
Something so that it looks the way that you want it to look as a developer, because it's convenient to you, it's going to slow you down sooner or later. It's not a question of if, it's a question of when. When you mesh most stuff close to reality, this is one of the things that we're at, this is how these are complex power. Because, I don't know, I think for system, it actually models reality closer than those layers that we're all used to, and oh, okay, this goes through there, and then always is what the thing we're dealing with looks like. And that's my general take, is just model stuff.
You might have to do something with the framework issue.
Just model stuff the way that they are. And then, like, changes in requirements and performance requirements, what those requirements are, in my experience, tend to be way easier to deal with.
But that also comes back to the famous WikiHeap presentation on simple versus easy.
Yep.
You see that also. And I think that's one of the things that like weights and hybrids are easy, but not necessarily simple. Because they are complexing many different things into one model. The main model takes commands versus the lead model that needs to present whatever for a web page.
Yeah. You just look at object oriented design in general. Right. The supposed latest incarnation is the DDD book. There he does talk about command query responsibility separation, but in a very micro level, right? It's really command methods and query methods, and you should mix the two. It's not an architectural thing, but it's sort of like the event approach is not very prevalent. Book, if I remember correctly.
But he changed that now.
But then you just look at OO from the beginning of time, events.
It was all about messages if you look at what Alan said.
But if you then look at CQRS, right? It really is events central to that.
It's a first.
His biggest screw up is calling it object oriented. He should call it message oriented.
Yeah, but I don't think his notion of messages is exactly the same as the CQRS notion of events, right? It's almost in your way of thinking, events first and foremost, and domain objects kind of almost secondary at some level.
I'm not sure, because I think the domain object is what reacts to the event. So a method call is an event that you send to the domain object, and then the domain object does something like that, and sends other events to other objects.
But you go back to Smalltalk, and you send messages to objects, but this notion of event stores and reconstructing...
That's a more architectural thing on a bigger level.
Yeah, but you're now forcing it all into your... You've taken that kind of... Which in some arguably is kind of a technical concern, right? And you've just forced it into your domain model.
Because when you test it, it's a huge difference. if you take a secret domain model, and you say, okay, given this command, I need to have at the result these events and these events only. So you can test for events that should be there, and you can also test for events that shouldn't be there. Whereas if you have a regular domain model, when you set in a command that changes it, it's how do you test that internal state is exactly what you want to
and
do?
And didn't do anything you didn't want to do.
Exactly.
You can poll a few things and say, oh yeah, all of these things are right. But unless you polled absolutely everything, you can't be sure that it didn't do something it shouldn't have.
Exactly. And that becomes so much easier if you use event sourcing, because you can test exactly what is coming out, both what should be there and what shouldn't be there.
I
think you're overstating the problem. I agree with you that there are situations where making assertions about the state of your system can be tricky. But I look back and it's not that hard, and I don't, you know, it doesn't make me go, gosh, I should throw everything I've been doing out of the window and completely embrace this CQRS approach.
Well, because if you're not used to it, it's hard. To me, it was easier because I'm used to it. Like that, I've never used that relationship.
But it's
normal.
It's quite. But to actually dismiss the non-CQRS approach is not sort of being useful and valid, and I think it's completely wrong, right? I mean, CQRS is not that popular, right?
Because it's not easy.
But despite that, and it's questionable whether it really is going to become widely adopted, right?
I think in places where it's important to be able to, make valid assumption about what happens, and also to have a clear separation of concerns and a clear picture or a clear model of your system, how it works, because as soon as you have state in there, I mean, I've done it myself, right? So if you have a complex domain with internal state, it's almost impossible to reason what it looks like inside when you have, after a certain lifetime running. It's almost non-deterministic.
There's lots of large complex systems have been written without CQRS over time, right? Smalltalk system itself was written without CQRS, right? I think there's a test in there probably, and so this assertion that it's impossible. I mean,
no, it's not impossible. It's harder to. Yeah. So for instance, if you want to. A bug happens, right? So you get a bug, and then you try to figure out why does this kind of thing happen. Of course, you have...
So if you do look at most of the most complex systems built in history, their event is, even done operating systems, systems, anything, like commission control systems, CAP systems, they're all event based.
Pretty much all embedded.
We have learned this. Now, CQRS is just... Web scaling event systems for high query rates. That's just a technique, and that doesn't necessarily work.
I guess what I'm referring to is the mechanism where objects respond to commands, that causes an event, and then the domain ends.
So
aggregates have event handlers.
But how does anything get into your system?
Well, obviously you've got requests coming in, you've got messages
and there are
coming
events.
In.
But so the only thing you can't get rid of out of your system is events. You have to have events. You have to deal with events. What you do with those events.
But I mean, but then to construct your domain objects in this sort of CQRS event sourcing way, and then to never assist their state, but reconstruct them by replaying. I guess I would just argue that yes, you can do it that way, but you can also persist the state, and that works quite well. Also,
yes, all right, I agree.
And so, what I'm reacting to is kind of I'm hearing this message that it's the only CQRS is the only way to do things, and if you do it any other way, it's impossible, and you can't test your code, which is simply not true.
So, but from a personal experience, I think at least it's harder to. To reason about what's happening in a system that just accumulates data in itself.
And then that becomes less decisional.
And to
sometimes.
to find bugs.
You fix everything with sometimes.
Yeah, and to from just my personal experience, yeah. And to find bugs and fix bugs is hard because you it's so much so many moving parts somehow, right? And they all go into the same thing, and then you have to kind of figure out what happened and which sequence and,
yeah.
and so on.
I had one of those cases in practice early on in the case management systems when we had bugs and your customer call and say, oh, we did this and this and something weird happened. And then you go into the event log and you see, oh, this user clicked this at this time and then this user clicked this and this resulted. Oh, we had a something wrong in the causation and we're doing the event log created. So it took like 5 minutes. Find it, identify it, and fix it. And without that kind of help, it would have been tricky.
So what are the downsides of CQRS other than unfamiliarity? Because you know there must be some, right? It is not perfect.
I think the familiarity is a good point.
That's a good
And I think what's happened is, like, so everyone has, there's been a lot of people in foundation, especially coming into our industry since the birth of the web. The web introduced the document model to us, and everything becomes request response. So a lot of people are trained up on request response driven systems. And I don't see CQRS sites, so I think it is a red herring. It's where a system's event is, or whether it's request response is. How you deal with those events in many different techniques. Persistence is another thing. But
yeah.
This request response, we expect to get always to get a response from them. Actually, have the idea of events are coming in and events are coming out. It's actually more the real world. I find event systems more the real world because it is more realistic. Like, a stimulus can happen sort of in the room. A number of us can choose to interact with it. Some can choose not at all. We're all dealing with our own state models. And otherwise,
if
you make a request response, we've all got to deal with it. So I think that these models that are request response don't scale just by the nature. What's also the problem is even slightly complex.
Because it has to translate from what is fundamentally TCP and UDP are fundamentally event-based. You've got a stream coming in, you've got a stream coming out, and we can start to sort of make correlations between those two, but fundamentally that's what's happening. And then that gets translated into a request response model or a more procedural model. You go through some translation, but the act of going through that translation is where you add complexity and where you lose some of your scalability. As a result. And so if you pair back a system, say, often people talk about, well, how easy is it to write some code? How easy is it to start up? And for most applications, that's the most important thing, which is fine. But certainly in training systems, it's the other way around. How can I take stuff out? What can I take out? What do I not need to be doing to still do, get down to the essentials of what this system has to do? And it's always the case that the one thing you cannot get rid of is event-driven, because you always have events coming into the system. That's a known constraint. You will have events coming in, you will send events out. So everything else is something that you want to actively try and take out of your system if you can. And that's why you get this sort of, perhaps have this dogmatic mindset that, no, you don't add in things that we don't need to be doing. Which is not necessarily correct for all applications, but that's certainly for trading systems. That's the one thing we want to hammer into people.
I think that makes it easier, and this is a big point, is the request response model means that you quite often don't have to deal with intermediate states. So you can sort of say, do this, and do this. All of a sudden, very easy to package those up. But then you lose the ability to catch what's going wrong. It's okay to be so glad with an exception of it. What if you've actually done some persistence or some mutation as one of those steps? How do I rewind it?
And then you have to put in transactions.
But I think the most unique event, you go, do an event, have state transitions to my next state, and then I go to state transition again based on another event. That's real. I know what state I'm in, I know what mutation I've done, and I can choose to compensate or continue. And then that puts more burden on the individual to actually think that way to begin with. But once you've taken that step,
now
the scalable system.
You don't have
I agree with everything you said, but I guess I view that as but then I could put CQRS event sourcing in, that's another separate concern.
Well, if events coming into a system, if I want to scale it, all I can scale is
discovery of weights and rights in C jurisdiction. That's just a technique. Persistence. I can write to it as a deal, I can write it to a file, I can keep it in my memory, I can it. That's a different cross-cutting concern if I deal with persistence. That's separate from the fact that I have an event-based system.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, like, from truly speaking, I think an event-based system where I just use, like, message broken, RabbitMQ, and sure. I want, and then I'll use my favorite framework because I'm a framework junkie.
That's what I think.
I use like Spring integration with this, integration pattern, pre-built patterns, and so on.
So I think the biggest problem is that humans are not used to think in this way. So we are used to do direct manipulation, right? We interact with our environment by manipulating things directly and changing their state immediately, right? That is a series of events underneath. It's not visible to our brains. What happens to the world? So we just see direct manipulation. So it's far much easier to reason in the first place about kind of what happens if I do this and do this and this, I just change these things and then it has a new overall state, right? So for someone to deal with a problem, in the first place it's easier to just do all of the stuff directly because it maps more to our mental model of the world, how we feel it is. But then doing an event-based system takes really an effort to take a step back and think more and be more aware of how things work, and that's why it's just too much effort for most people to go this way. And if they don't have the kind of external requirements to, for instance, with the scalable system or this and that, they just have to kind of get a job done, then you know the easy way wins all the time.
The approximation is that one thing I like about that is white box or black box. The job is done when this system exhibits the behavior that needs to do. So if an event comes in, I expect a set of events to come out. The job's done. I'm not paid for what I do inside that box. All I'm paid for is stimulus comes in, stimulus comes out. And then I say, how do I approach that? We seem to start off with the inside thing and then come out in our design, whenever we go out with the other players. So we end up with like technologies and abstractions and approximations. The system almost works by side effect, yes, rather than by describing next.
So this is like Newtonian versus Einstein thing. Yeah, it's a good approximation, but yeah. In the point of view.
The way I think of it is top-down design versus bottom-up design. So a lot of infrastructure people in particular will start with a bottom-up design. They want to provide a good, ideal infrastructure. So they start with the pieces that they have, and they put some layers on it to kind of smooth out the creases and all the bumps. And then slowly you put more and more layers out, and you get something that's smoother and smoother, hopefully, but further and further removed from what the machine's actually doing. And what the danger is that the infrastructure group ends up producing something that's far more complicated than it's really needed, because they're not basing it on actual requirements, they're basing it on trying to smooth out all the known issues with this underlying system. And IT in general tends to do that quite a lot, so they don't go back to the business enough and say, well, what's actually needed here, and end up developing all sorts of things that...
put out on the seat as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's really... I mean, that pattern is really common, right?
Like, it's very
common. You know, come to me, they put all the smart people into the platform, and then they have other people just working on...
It should be the other way around.
Yeah, I guess you need to attack it from both directions, so that you're starting with the business side, you say, what are the actual requirements? But also, at some point, you have to look at the reality of what hardware you've got, actually got, what software have you actually got available to you, and so on.
I mean, I would make everybody work on end user, on business requirements.
At some point in their career, otherwise...
On a very regular basis, actually,
yes.
And then, okay, it's like, you need to evolve the infrastructure to support... To do, I mean, it's basically you need to evolve the infrastructure to better support the business requirements, and you do that. But people shouldn't. I just think it's a disaster if developers are too far removed from the actual business.
Yeah.
I think that's a brilliant conversation. I think we've been in the sense of we've probably seen genuine issues in the real world. We're building the perfect systems. We know we don't have perfect people to build them, and we start bridging this gap. We know some of the techniques to do work, but they're quite hard. We know the things people like to do, there's a psychology of prettiness sometimes.
Yeah.
How do we get sort of the things that really do work more fast, make them more fast, so people want to adopt them?
So I think one of the aspects is what Dan North says about deliberative discovery. So when you focus on the learning aspect, so you don't build systems to live for a long time, but you build systems to learn stuff, and then you just are able to throw them away and do it with what you've learned. And then you're not bound to the old mistakes and you're not bound to the old craft, but you can say, okay, we did a system, it worked, it still works, but we want to take our learnings and stuff that other people bring in and build the next generation from ground up with, you know, clean slate, and
yeah,
you don't get bogged down by all the craft that you accumulated and so on. So that's, I think it's a good way of dealing with this problem, because otherwise if you stay in the same system and you just want to make it better or, you know, add stuff, so you get, you know, it gets more and more complex, and
you build up your technical debt very quickly.
Yeah.
I like the idea of microservice architectures, right, where you've got lots of small apps that you can throw away
individually without too much risk.
Yeah.
Yes. But you think that the question sort of similar to like the discussion we have with C-Press and event sourcing, like how can you start simple with that and then sort of, you know,
yeah,
like because you don't want to do it too late, because then you already have this monolithic thing.
Yeah, I mean, I have a slide in one of my talk on this. It's like where it sort of says in the beginning you don't have the problems of this architecture solved.
Yeah.
Yet. But later on, when you have scaled, you actually have customers, then you've got a tangled set of dependencies and it's hard to keep it parallel.
There's a nice talk from Werner Vogel from Amazon, CTO, where he explains the history of Amazon, the architecture, and it was first this kind of huge monolithic thing that is scaled on the database side, the app server side, but it was still this monolithic application. But they were brave enough to just cut the cord and do it all with tiny services and teams around the services would do the whole life cycle, so it's a whole approach somehow. And that's, but you have to be brave enough and you have to be able to do that.
Conway as well. Any system ends up being shaped by organization and built it.
Yes.
It's not actually a technical problem. Mm-hmm. Right? What Amazon did is they said, you're responsible for personalization, you're responsible for paying credit card debts, whatever. You've got the business responsibility and to build the technology. You've got the building the technology just to do that. If you do credit cards, you don't do personalization.
On
a protocol, actually, not even on a framework. Just on protocol.
I think many companies, Amazon went through that monolithic microservice architecture. I think eBay did as well, and also Netflix. I suspect most companies they've gone through that.
Yeah.
And it's funny. I mean, I remember talking with some company a while back, and their whole system was massive, millions of lines of code, war file. They were figuring pain.
And in terms of reflecting, one of the most common things I see is that it ends up being that if you've got, like, say, Maven modules or something, there'll be a module based on the developer. So the developer really only works on one module, to the point where some modules end up being named after the developer. One project I've worked on is a whole bunch of modules called Lars something, because Lars worked on it.
Well, I saw a few projects who attempt to move into that small app-style service-oriented architecture, but they kind of failed they still have that monolithic thinking in their mind, and now they try to move to smaller modules, but they still mix them up. So they are still too big and too complex, and the events and messages are still very monolithic thinking, so it's not like thinking of small modules that you can that a specific one special task, and so they still kind of have events just
to have two different modules communicate with each other without like making it more general?
The most common problem I see is when once a project gets too big, whatever that size is it becomes it only ever grows. It becomes too large for anyone to understand the whole system. So no one can take anything out. And so it just gets to a critical mass, and then suddenly it just grows and grows and grows. And then the technical weight just grows as well. So the development in the projects just slow down almost proportional to this oversizing. And that the biggest downside of that I've seen is that it becomes depressing for the developers to work on it. They get upset because they know that they should take less time to do the work that they're having to do. It's taking them forever, and in many cases they end up leaving because the it just got too bad.
Someone said was it Michael? He said something about 30,000 lines of code is about how much you can keep in your head.
Yeah, there probably is.
Cognitive
baggage. Yeah, this has got 18,000 classes, and as far as I can work out, 90% is needed. That's the level of technical debt they're at.
Does anyone know Fred George?
Yes.
Because he's big into microservices and developer anarchy and fascinating guy.
That's true.
I mean, you just have a whole lot of tiny services, and you just write them in whatever language is best suited, and you just throw them away regularly.
I think the throwaway aspect is almost the most important one, because of course you can also go the other way around and say, okay, I create many services, but I make them reusable, so I can
reuse. They're all in one monolithic code.
Right? I make them reusable, so I can use the same service from 5 or 10 or 20 different applications, whatever, right? But actually you don't want to do that, because then it gets more generic and it gets more tangled, because it has to deal with lots of different concerns from many, many things. But the throwaway, or just copy something, cut out all the stuff you don't actually need, and then that's the new basis on what you want to do, right? So
it's interesting about the complexity. For example, you distributed system versus a system of machine these days. Actually, it's a problem. It's the mumble problem, actually. You've got shared memory, constantly shared memory, people are doing odd things. So you end up with a tightly coupled. So, for example, you or something like that as a microservice. It's not that everything whether it's distributed on different machines or distributed on the same machine, and you're able to just throw it away or replace it with a new one. In fact, if you have the ability to share memory space, it just causes this tangling to happen.
Yeah.
And it's all able to be tied together.
I worked with one guy, his model was interesting. They had a very low latency network using InfiniBand, and he put every thread on a different box.
By intent,
yes. So each box was only really running one thread that was related to the business, and the rest of the box was just there to avoid any jitter between threads.
I'm quite not as a side fact. Like, one example is like people quite big boxes thinking they're going to be faster and more scalable, so I tend to basically break them down to services and run on a socket. Mm-hmm. And I'll use the uplinks as a network. The side effect of that is you keep getting better decoupled applications. You start with performance problem, you actually end up with nicer code, because they start piecing the things apart. And you give them a really fast IPC mechanism. It just becomes really nice.
So you set it one socket, one thread, but you have many of them on the chain.
Or even many socket, or many threads running on the same socket. You just constrain to do no individual services working row beyond that size.
It's kind of enforcing Conway's law by hardware,
yeah,
kind of format.
Yeah, right? Just, you wouldn't sort of solve performance problems, but I think performance contained performance software. I think Conway got this right. In the organization you build something gets reflected in the code. You can always read code and do a psychological profile of the team you build it.
Yeah.
You can see it.
Probably some metrics that you can probably come up with.
Yeah.
The other thing I find is that often with technical debt as the project evolves is that you get poor code and slower delivery and all that sort of stuff, but people don't tend to complain about that, or it doesn't get heard in the management level. or it's not visible to the end users. What's first visible to the end users is when the system stops performing. And so the users complain, this goes up to senior management. So it comes through as a performance problem, when actually the root cause was building up all this time. And when you get in here, you find that, well, yeah, performance is an issue, but the fundamental reason why performance is an issue is based on this poor code base or organizational, or your team's now really demotivated or whatever. Something that's been building up for a while, but the thing was that it was performance that really triggered management to make a decision.
Well, sort of the way organizations run is that the technical data is invisible.
Until the performance.
But then it's actually too late, they probably need a few years to solve the problem if they want to change the system and all things.
I mean, so you sort of want CIOs to have a dashboard that, you know, has various code quality metrics.
I think they really don't see it until the other issues. Yeah, performance is one place where it shows up. Is when all of a sudden the cost for adding new features starts escalating, right? And that's another trigger to say, okay.
Well, cost for support issues.
Cost for bug fixes, cost for new features.
But they tend to see that as the developers getting slower and slower or something. They tend not to
see that as technical debt.
So that means your development team is no good and we're going to outsource it to India or something.
Yeah, right. Or any external company that promises all sorts of things.
Yeah.
With Mark, the componentization idea is like one of the things that often recommended is when people say, yeah, let's get bigger boxes. Says, well, why don't you go get a whole bunch of smaller, cheaper ones, right?